Hello and welcome to the Journal of Democracy podcast. I'm Brent Kalmer, managing editor of the journal, and I'm joined today by Matthias Matisse, who is the author of Mediterranean Blues, The Crisis in Southern Europe. Now, a word about Matthias. He is assistant professor of international political economy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's also author of Ideas and Economic Crises in Britain from Attlee to Blair and co-editor of The Future of the Euro. That's with Mark Blith, and that's coming this year. So welcome, Matthias.
Thank you.
Now let's start right in with some snippets from your article. Very interesting piece. I'm going to read you a quote and just get your thoughts on it.
Okay.
So you write that, quote, between 1945 and the early 1970s, countries in financial distress had at their disposal four national-level economic shock absorbers to help them out of a crisis, unquote. So what were these shock absorbers, and how did monetary union impact the ability of individual countries to use them?
Yeah, great question. The four shock absorbers, in short, I refer to are inflation, deflation, devaluation, and default. So that's, economists would cringe at this because I'm using it the wrong way. So I'm using it from a policy point of view. And so inflation basically means a kind of broad demand stimulus, cutting taxes, increasing spending. Deflation is what we see all over Europe now and is becoming popular in the US, and it's called austerity. It means the opposite, spending cuts and to some extent tax increases. Devaluation is basically that you try to adjust your economy or rebalance your economy through an external channel, and that's through the exchange rate in this case. So you make the dollar or your currency cheaper, that means it's easier to export your goods abroad, and that way you can bring growth back. It will also make goods from abroad more expensive, so people will tend to buy more at home rather than they will buy stuff from abroad. And then default is some kind of, you know, the structure, restructuring of your debt. Well, here it very much depends whether the debt is held by foreigners or by people domestically, right? The distribution will be different. So most countries today still have all those shock absorbers at their disposal. Right? That doesn't mean that they're all great, but, you know, the United States, they're using a kind of weak dollar combined with demand stimulus. The United Kingdom today is using austerity policies, but also with a kind of policy of devaluation and of monetary stimulus. The problem I see in the main European countries is that they have given up two of the four since the Treaty of Maastricht because they have a common currency, which means they can devalue the euro, but that's only relevant for the Europe vis-a-vis the rest of the world, not for Germany vis-a-vis Italy or Greece vis-a-vis France. And that's one thing they've given up. And because of the European Central Bank, its main mandate is to fight inflation, and they have a stability pact where they supposedly, you know, can't run big deficits. That means that they really don't have inflation and devaluation at their disposal. Default is what I call the nuclear option. So you're left with austerity, which basically means that the countries of Southern Europe, the main focus of the article, they don't have a choice but to do austerity cuts. And it's not because they want to, but it's because, you know, it's imposed, at least that's the perception, it's imposed by Brussels and by Frankfurt.
And the catch-22 seems to be that austerity could be precisely the wrong prescription in the situation that some of these Southern European countries find themselves in. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And it's also based on a misdiagnosis that somehow the crisis in Southern Europe was because of too much public spending, right? I mean, we know that to some extent this was true in Greece, but this was definitely not the case in a country like Spain, where you had a private sector, a banking crisis, the banks need to be bailed out. That means that then those countries find themselves with all this debt on their public balance sheets. And so it's kind of blaming the victim to some extent here, that we blame governments for excessive spending, and there's not really any good evidence of this. Even in the case in Greece, there's a lot of stories about it, but if you look at the actual data, I mean, it's not that spending was rampantly out of control apart from maybe the last couple of years.
And Greece obviously has been a focus of the crisis, and it was kind of the part of Europe that first brought the crisis to the public imagination. And with these austerity measures, you've seen the rise of some of these extremist parties, particularly in Greece with Golden Dawn. There are European Parliament elections coming up this spring. Is it to be expected that some of these extremist parties will make substantial gains?
Yeah, I think that is a very main worry of the European elites right now. Because one of the main issues I see for Southern Europe is also, it's the lack of legitimacy of the European institutions. So how do you solve the lack of legitimacy? Well, you get more democratic involvement. But then the question is one of be careful what you wish for, right? Because, if it does become more democratic, we do see the rise of these parties. So first of all, you have Golden Dawn, an openly neo-Nazi party in Greece, but also you have on the extreme left, a party like Syriza, those two together could have close to 40% in the next elections in Greece. And Syriza objects to any of the bailout measures that Europe has imposed. At the same time, in Italy, you have this five-star movement that we don't really know what they stand for, that got 25% of the vote in the last Italian elections. They're supposed to be doing very well in the next election. But it's broader. It's a broader European phenomenon. We're looking towards a situation in May, in the European elections in Europe, where Marine Le Pen's Front National in France might be the biggest party in France, where the United Kingdom's Independence Party, UKIP, which is kind of a right-wing nationalist party, could be the biggest party in the UK. And the same with Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom in the Netherlands could also be the biggest one. So it's not just in Southern Europe that the nastiest elements, especially in the case of Golden Dawn, are in Southern Europe. But this is a phenomenon all over Europe that national publics are saying, well, we simply no longer control what goes on in Europe. And for better or worse, and I think that's an important lesson, legitimacy remains with the nation state and not with the European institutions in Brussels.
Now, this leads into another quote from the piece that I want to read to you, and that is this. Quote, there is already ample evidence that the strength of liberal democracy in Southern Europe has diminished since 2010. As seen in a weakening of civil and political rights, the rule of law, and the functioning of government, unquote. So there seems to be a democratic crisis kind of in the offing as well. Is that overstating it?
No, I think it's true to, there is some real evidence, especially in the case of Italy and Greece. They've been downgraded by Freedom House. The Economist and Tarzan has downgraded them somewhat. And I think it is deserved from the point of view also. Greece and Italy, here are the two countries, the beacons of democracy, right, where they, did experiments with it 2,000 years ago. And here you had two countries where Brussels had to install a kind of technocratic leader for over a year. Now they're back to some kind of democratic leadership, but still, that shows you that the mainstream center-left and center-right parties have a very hard time to form coalitions now. And also, the moment that they might even agree, it's seen that, the programs they ran on in elections, they're not being honored. So it's still this imposition from outside, either from the markets, from Washington, from Brussels, that they then have to follow. And that explains why people are kind of flocking towards these extremist parties. That being said, I'm mostly worried about Greece because I think there's no light at the end of the tunnel yet. When it comes to their economic recovery. Spain and Portugal, I think, are less problematic. But even though there you see that the mainstream parties, center-left and center-right, have seen a dramatic fall in their support. And so one of the main things when you look at civil rights and political rights, it's the sense that there really is no choice with the established parties. And I think that is what's problematic.
Now, you also present some interesting data with respect to the percent of people who trust the EU throughout Europe. And the divergence between Northern Europe and Southern Europe is really quite stunning with this opinion data. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Yeah, it's a very good question because I think it's often overlooked. People like to say, it's been the mistrust of Europe has been going up all over Europe. And that's true to some extent. And they also say that most of the EU analysts say, well, most countries still, they trust their national governments just as little as they trust EU institutions. Well, here I think it's important if you look closely, that is not entirely true. So the lack of trust in the EU has gone down way faster and farther in Southern Europe than the trust in their own government, even though that's at very low levels as well. But what you do see is in the northern countries, in a way, the countries that got their way in the debt crisis, that got their ideas implemented, especially Germany, but also the Netherlands, Austria, Luxembourg, Finland, that you see there the trust in the EU is actually quite high. With the exception of Germany, where the trust in the EU is less than the trust in their own government. So it's really the big winner in all these opinion polls has been, astoundingly actually, Angela Merkel, that Germans really seem to trust their own chancellor even more so than Europe.
The trust problem is probably related to a general sense of economic outlook. And one of the interesting or kind of disturbing points that you allude to in the piece is how much unemployment there is for people who are under 25 years of age. These are high and sustained levels of unemployment. What does that mean for the future of the EU?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you put your finger in the wound in a way, because I think that's the biggest problem. I mean, think about, here are four Southern European countries that are relatively young democracies, with the exception of Italy, but that's had a very turbulent democratic past, at least since World War II. But look at Greece that joined in 1982 and Portugal and Spain that joined Europe in 1986. For a whole generation, for 30 years, they've seen nothing but good things coming from Europe. Faster growth, better roads, cheap air travel, exchange programs in universities and so on. So for a whole generation of youth, Europe was kind of the promised land in a way, right? I mean, this was what was delivering. Also, this was a generation, the previous generation, that was still very well aware, you know, what anti-democratic and authoritarian regimes looked like, and also the legacy of World War II. We have a completely new generation that doesn't remember Franco, that doesn't remember Salazar, doesn't remember the Greek junta. They also don't particularly remember much of World War II anymore. Even their grandparents at this point, right, of the new generation, don't really, you know, didn't really live through it. So now what do you see is those youths, they graduate from college or they don't graduate from college, but there's no work. Greece, 2 out of 3. Spain, 2 out of 3 are out of a job. In Italy, it's 40%. In Portugal, it's close to 40%. It's fallen just a little bit in the last couple of months. But, you know, an improvement from 65% to 63.5% is hardly something to, you know, write home about. And so what's worrisome is that the whole of Southern Europe was a big supporter of further European integration, right? They saw the benefits from this. And now you have the risk that a whole generation will say, well, sorry, this the game is not worth the candle. Maybe we should turn our back towards Europe and, you know, take our own economy and our own country back in our own hands and run it from a point of view that's good for our people rather than this endless austerity. And I think that's what's worrisome. That, I mean, in general, now the big fans of European integration are the very old people. The youth is no longer on board. And I mean, if you want a project to succeed, you need to convince its youth. And I think that's where Europe should be a lot more worried about youth unemployment than they are right now.
Let's go out on a question that is more kind of on the periphery of Europe, and this is Ukraine, where protesters have turned out in droves against President Viktor Yanukovych's abandonment of a free trade agreement with Europe and the consequent turn toward Russia. Washington Post columnist Jim Hoagland recently wrote that, quote, Europe must renew its support for Ukraine's democratic forces, not only for their own sake, but also to revitalize the European Union's own flagging sense of purpose, unquote. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I find myself going back and forth with this. I mean, I think it's a fair assessment. I think Europe should have done a lot more for Ukraine. I mean, in the end, if Russia can push its agenda, surely Europe can push its agenda, right? I mean, from that realist international relations point of view, Europe should do what's in its interest and Russia should. But then, I mean, Ukraine is a country that's genuinely torn. You have an east that's very close to Russia and a west that's very close to Europe. I mean, it's literally almost split down the middle. And I think what's often not reported, especially here in D.C. or in the west more general, is that it's not so much a pro-Russian as a pro-Western, pro-EU cleavage, as also just an old-fashioned left versus right cleavage on that kind of political political spectrum. People who support Yanukovych tend to be more left of center when it comes to socioeconomic policy, right? More oriented towards, you know, what the state is doing for us, the development of the welfare state, the protection from globalization. In the end, the right, and that was, I mean, Yushchenko's party and the Orange Revolution and Timoshenko, what they also stand for is kind of for more pro-business policies, for less protection from the state. And so young people, people that are educated, are doing well, they, of course, will support that kind of movement. So I think even when I talk to Ukrainians here in D.C. about this, I mean, many of them even themselves are genuinely torn with this. Of course, they're part of Russia, and they always will be, and they don't want to turn their back to it. But many of them are very Western, and they want to, you know, the opportunity that comes with accession or just more interaction with the European Union. And then Europe has to be careful, right? I mean, especially much of Central Europe is so heavily reliant on natural gas from Russia that there's only that much they can push. And as long as it's not clear that there is a full majority of Ukraine that's ready to join the West, then it becomes a much harder case. And I think that will also be true in the case of NATO expansion, right? I mean, we'd love to push this agenda further because we see this as a democratizing force. But on the other hand, I think there's very little support in Ukraine itself of completely like cutting off all ties with Russia to join the West. So I think, I mean, in a way, Jim Hoglund is right. But on the other hand, the Ukrainian people need to decide what they want. And I think they are genuinely torn. And it's almost that, I mean, breaking up the country in an eastern part and a western part would be a better solution than this constant, you know, back and forth between left and right or pro-West and pro-Russian. And this, you know, endless protests that have been going on for quite a couple of months now.
And they seem to be intensifying. We'll, of course, be watching those closely.
Yes.
But thank you for joining us today, Matthias. My guest has been Matthias Matisse. He is the author of Mediterranean Blues, The Crisis in Southern Europe, which is available in the January 2014 issue of the Journal of Democracy. Come check it out. You will be glad that you did. And thank you so much.
Very welcome. A great pleasure.